is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey Hoopheads, our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are here to help your team train bigger and better with exclusive Black Friday savings all month long. Now until November 30th, get $3,500 off the Dr. Dish CT Plus and experience firsthand what the ultimate training solution is all about. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Those are some great deals, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hey, this is Byron Burt, head boys basketball coach at St. Lawrence High School in Burbank, Illinois, and you're listening to Hoopheads podcast.
Are you a basketball coach or trainer looking to connect with new clients? U-Train is here to help you manage your business and reach a wider audience. Best of all, it's completely free to use. Simply create a profile, list your services, post pins, and share your free booking website link. You can set your own rates and schedule and use U-Train to communicate with clients, manage appointments, handle refunds, and collect payments automatically. So why wait? Join U-Train today for free and start reaching new clients. That's U-Train, U-T-R-A-I-N, U-Train. Download today on the App Store and Google Play. Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. FastModel also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. FastModel Sports is the best in basketball. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight. And we are joined by Rob Brost, head boys basketball coach at Bolingbrook High School for triple double number 5. Rob, welcome in.
Great to be back on number 5. This is kind of like rounding out our starting lineup with the fifth episode here. So I'm looking forward to this one as well.
Yeah, some good stuff. We are recording this on the evening of November 2nd, about to here in Cleveland, Ohio, about to turn into November 3rd. But the season is almost upon us. So we thought we would pick out some topics that are relevant for coaches here as we are starting our seasons, depending on where you are in the country and what level you coach, especially at the high school level. You're probably just starting or just about to start. And so we wanted to hit on some topics that we thought would be relevant for this time of year. So let's start out with topic number one, Rob. The emphasis for the first week of practice. I know this is something that when you talk to coaches, or I think back to my experience as a high school coach, there's always a million things that you feel like you want to get in, you want to get done, you have to get done before the next game. And so trying to narrow that down and figure it all out is always a challenge. So how do you approach that?
Well, I think, you know, every coach is different, and I'll just kind of explain how we do it at Bolingbrook High School. I don't know if it's the right way or the good way or it's the appropriate way, but it's just the way we do it. You know, obviously we have a checklist of things that we want to get done before the first contest. But my main two things that I emphasize as the head coach is going hard all of the time. And so we talk about, if we're not going hard, then we're going to practice going hard. And nobody wants that. Nobody wants me to be involved in that decision-making process of them not going hard. And so One of the things we do to make sure that happens is we give our team, the entire team, one timeout per practice. So if they call the timeout before I notice that that stuff is going on, in other words, not going hard, then they can kind of correct that on their own and, you know, meet as a group or whatever they need to do. And so the first major emphasis is going hard. And then the second one, and neither one of these really have to do with X's and O's necessarily. The second one is decision-making. And decision-making runs the gamut for us. That's obviously decision-making on the floor, but decision-making relative to being a good teammate and decision-making on how you're going to interact with the coaching staff and decision-making on how you're going to interact with the lower level student athletes as well. So, you know, we really want to emphasize, or I really want to emphasize those two things. Obviously, there's a lot of X's and O's things that we want to get accomplished, especially in the first week. However, those pale in comparison to the two things that I mentioned, going hard all the time, and then number two, decision-making, obviously on the court, and decision-making relative to being a good teammate and doing the right things for our entire program.
All right, so let's dive deeper into the decision-making part of it.
Yeah.
When you talk about decision-making in terms of being a great teammate, what does that look like? How do you get that message across to players that that's something that you are emphasizing, that you are watching? Is that a matter of picking out the things that you're looking for? Is that a matter of talking about formally, hey, here's what we think a great teammate is, here's what we want to see you doing? How do you approach that?
Yeah. One of the things we do, and this will usually be the second or third practice, when kind of when we've had the first round of cuts already made, we will go in the classroom before we start practice, and then I'll simply ask this question: what does a good teammate do? Like, what do they do? What do good teammates do? And I will just write up on the board everything that the guys say, and you will be shocked. No one ever says, oh, he's a great shooter, or he handles the ball well, or he's very quick, or he's very fast. Anything to do with basketball, they all say is positive, goes hard all the time, encourages teammates, picks others up, is coachable, there's eye contact, all of those things. The kids bring those things up. And then we talk about, is there anybody in this room that can't do all of those things? And to a man, they all agree that all of them can do all of those things. And so that's the first, you know, expectation of our team, is that you're a good teammate, number one. And you know, I tell our guys, you know, it's not going to go how you want it. No one here, including our best player, is going to play as much as they want or as well as they want all the time. And so it's just not going to go exactly how you want it. So can you continue to be a good teammate when you personally aren't playing well, or you're having a bad day, or you got a bad score in your biology class and then you have practice right after that, or whatever the case may be? So I think being a good teammate is really critical for us, not only the first week, but all the time. Because if you're not doing that, there's no way you can be a part of what we're doing. And not to say that it's perfect, because it's certainly not. But I think we've done a really good job, you know, the past 10, 12 years in particular, of, you know, setting the expectation of being a good teammate.
Yeah. So clearly, with the way that your program is and the culture that you built, those expectations are in place. Kids know that coming into the first
yes.
practice. How much of that are you talking about in your off season as well? Because clearly, again, especially at the varsity level, right, you know the guys that you're going to
yep.
be working with. They've been around you. They know what to expect. But you have some younger guys that are part of the program that are maybe
yep.
coming up to the varsity for the first time. But it's not the first time that they're hearing it. Is it on day one of practice? On Monday, that's not
right.
going to be the first time they hear about finding out that, hey, I got to be a good
Correct.
Teammate. What's this all about? Never heard this before.
I think we're at a really huge advantage in that our program is pretty established. And I'm not talking from a wins and losses standpoint. You know, I'm talking about players that come back. We have seven guys that are playing Division I basketball right now. They all come back in the summer, talk to our kids, work out with our kids. So the expectations and what we have come to, you know, deem as appropriate behavior as far as being a good teammate is really exemplified by the older kids. And when I mean older kids, some of the kids that have already been all the way through the program and are out of it. You know, some of our guys will come back from college, for example, and say, hey, this is the best atmosphere. This is the best culture that you're ever going to play for. Because when you get to college, everybody's in it for themselves, including the coaches, the players, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, I think we're lucky that we've been able to establish this and that our former players do a really good job of coming back and, you know, teaching, I guess, by example more than verbally what the expectations are. And so I tell our guys all the time this phrase: if your relationship with me is dependent on if you play, how much you play, or how well you play, then you're in the wrong place. We're going to have to do what's best for each other and trust each other regardless of those three items. And so that's sometimes difficult for 15, 16, 17-year-old kids. But on the other hand, it's very refreshing when they have adults that understand that they don't need anything from them. Like, for example, if my starting two guard, whoever that is, if he goes 1 for 7 one night, I'm not going to badmouth him everywhere I go and wish we had another two guard. That's my two guard. So I think they know and understand that. And so it's refreshing from their point of view that an adult is like that with them. And then it's rather refreshing for us that they're like that with us. And again, it's not perfect and it doesn't go exactly how you want it ever. But I think we've been fortunate enough to really cultivate a culture where that's the case.
What about the decision-making on the floor?
Yeah, the decision-making on the floor is a very important piece of it because it really reflects your attitude and whether you're being a good teammate. So whether you're playing unselfish basketball, if you're not going hard, that's selfish because you're not pushing your teammates to the level that they need to be pushed. And you're not pushing yourself to the level that you need to be pushed. So that's a selfish thing to do. And so the decision making on the court is very critical as well. And so those things go hand in hand. The going hard and the decision making go hand in hand. So if you're going hard all the time, you're a lot less likely to be selfish because going hard in and of itself is an unselfish act. And not going hard is selfish. So, you know, we talk about all those things, but then we emphasize and, you know, positively influence when we see those things happening on a daily basis. And are you the teammate that's helping other people? Or are you the teammate that's only worried about yourself? And then obviously there's a decision-making piece of it on, like literally on the floor when you're playing. You know, are you turning it over? Are you making the extra pass? Are you taking, you know, really difficult shots? Are you taking shots that aren't within our system? And all of those things are coached to our guys, what those things look like and what those things are. And they're different for each player, obviously, because each player has a different skill set. But our guys understand what we're trying to do as far as how we play. And we play, as you know, really, really fast. And really, really unselfishly, and we try to put a lot of pressure on the rim as far as that goes. And so those are the shots that we try to get primarily. And when we're not getting those shots, that's selfish. So it goes with being a good teammate, and then it obviously goes on the floor as well.
What I love about what you said, Rob, in all honesty, is the fact that those three components, so decision making on the floor, decision making, I guess, off the court, but as a yep. teammate, that's not a direct basketball skill, and then playing hard. Like, to me, those are things that permeate everything that you want to have happen in your program, regardless of whether it's the first day of practice, the first week of practice, your last practice before the state championship game, your summer league game, your workouts in the summer, right? Those are all things, those three things, if you could get those to permeate throughout everything that you do, you're solving a lot of problems before you even figure out, like, okay, how are we going to play and how are we yes. meshing together as a team and what kind of defense are we going to be running? And hey, have we prepared adequately for this game? If you could take care of those three things that you talked about that you're emphasizing in week one, those have nothing to do with how much strategic planning you did in the offseason yes. of how are we going to X's and O's and scheme against this team, or what are we going to do to stop this team's fast break, or how are we going to play against their pressure defense or whatever. Those are things that no matter what you do as a coach, if you get those three things out of your team, you're so far ahead of where most teams are that if you can cement that, and like I said, you've obviously put your program in a position where you're not teaching all those things on the fly during the first week Correct. Of practice the way somebody who's yes. Maybe a brand new coach might have to do a little bit more of that. So you kind of have the ball rolling downhill, so to speak. But for sure, if you get those things going, it makes everything so much easier.
No doubt. And it's just refreshing to sit where I sit when some of those things, I don't want to say take care of themselves, but now the upperclassmen kind of take that being a good teammate and they run with it and they take responsibility for it. And so that's really, really good. One, I just spoke at the Iowa Basketball Coaches Association Clinic, and one of the things I talked about was everybody wants extraordinary effort out of their players. Everybody wants that. But until you make your players feel extraordinarily valued, they're not going to give you that type of effort. So I think it's important that your players understand that they're valued, and then that they also understand that in my case, I'm not doing a good job as a coach if I'm allowing some of those things to just slide by. And so we're not going to do that as far as being a good teammate. Obviously, we'll work with every individual, and every individual is different as far as their needs, both on and off the floor. But we're not going to allow somebody or something to infiltrate the team on a long-term basis. So those are things that we emphasize, like you mentioned, all throughout the year, all the time. And so we don't have to start from scratch, you know, on Monday when we have our first practice.
At the same time, you're in a situation there where players are held accountable and you're in a more formal practice setting than you've been since last season ended. And yes. so even though you do have it established, you still are making it clear and emphasizing those three things, which permeate the entire program, are going to carry with you throughout the entire season, regardless of what kind of things you're doing in practice on a daily basis. Playing hard, making good decisions, those are universal skills that apply yes. throughout the year. So I think that's a really good way to look at that. All right, topic number two, handling cuts, something that no coaches enjoy the process of cutting a player and taking that basketball dream out of their hands. It's obviously something, especially if you're at a big school and you have a successful program, where you're going to have a large number of kids coming out for your teams, especially at lower levels, where yep. you have to be able to figure out what is the best way to handle those cuts. And we've all seen the different ways, right? We've heard the individual meeting with every player. We've heard the, yep. I post the team on the door and I'll meet with you if you want. We've heard I'll post the names on the door and I'm closing that door and I'm not talking to anybody as a result of that. So how do you approach it? What do you think is the right way to do it? What do you think is the way that is going to be most beneficial for both your program and for the kids that make the team and the kids who get cut?
Well, I think, again, I have no delusions of grandeur. All I can speak to is how we do it. I don't know if it's the right way, but we found it to be at least effective for us, so to speak. But it's the worst part, and there's not even a close second. It's the worst part of being a head coach is the cut piece. And, you know, when I first started at Bolingbrook, whatever it was, 16 years ago, it was not that difficult to cut kids because I was cutting kids that either had bad grades or bad attitudes, or I don't want to say weren't good kids, but you understand what I'm trying to say. Now, the kids that I'm cutting are all really good kids that have worked tremendously hard, a lot of them that have good grades, that have good attitudes, that show up all summer, all of those things. And so it's much more difficult to do that now because I'm not cleaning up a lot of stuff. I'm just trying to make the decisions that are best for the team. And so the first thing is that we do is we are completely honest with the players and completely honest with the parents. And you know, when we cut, we for the varsity level, we put everybody in one room and we call kids one by one, every single kid, whether they made it or they didn't make it, and it's in complete random order. We meet, my assistant and I. Two of my assistants are in the big room, and then two of my assistants are sitting with me. We meet with every single player. So it does take a fair amount of time to get that done. But I feel like we owe it to every single player. And so that's how we do it on the varsity levels. We meet with every single kid, make or cut, and have a discussion with each one of them because some of the discussions, like with the 10 through 15th guy, I tell them, like, hey, if we had a game right now, you wouldn't get in. Now, I'm not dumb. If you beat out players ahead of you, then there's a chance for you to play, obviously. But are you okay with where you're at right now? And some of them are, and some of them aren't. And so, you know, that plays a part into the decision making as well. And so, it's a little bit easier for me because we don't have the huge numbers that say our lower levels do. With our lower levels, you know, for our freshmen, we'll keep 25 because we have a freshman A and a freshman B, but we'll get 80 kids, you know, trying out for those 25 spots. And now that's difficult because the gap isn't, you know, as, you
I
know,
agree, Rob.
That's a lot of meetings.
Yes, that's a lot.
Middle
that's a
school
lot of
boys
meetings.
is the same way, Rob. I'm in a smaller school than you are, and we had 45 kids trying out for 20 spots because we have two teams. And it's like,
and the difference between those kids, even with me at the varsity level, the difference between kid number 11, if I was going to rank them 1 through 15. Kid number 11 and a kid that I cut that's number 18 is very minimal
Completely agree.
a lot of the
Completely agree.
time.
You're splitting hairs at that point.
It's very, very difficult. So then you rely back on some of the other things. Are you going to be a good teammate? What do I know about you from seeing you in the hallway? Have you been at work? All of those things play a part into it. And so, you know, I think it's much more difficult for my lower level coaches to get all that done just because of the sheer numbers of kids. Obviously, the top 5 to 10 is relatively easy. But then after that, it gets very, very difficult. So I have a special spot in my heart for those lower level coaches. And one of the things we do is we guarantee the kids 2 days, and this is especially at the lower levels, but we might not have the final decisions done until the end of the week. So some kids might have 5 days of practice because they feel like they need to see more or they're not comfortable yet making the cuts. And they'll just tell the kids, hey, if you don't want to chance it, if you don't want to keep coming, you don't have to keep coming. but if you want to keep coming, you can. And so they'll kind of cut a few after the first 2 days and then cut a few more after the third day. And then normally by Thursday or Friday, you know, they're down to their 25 kids because we have an A and B squad, like I said. So, you know, that's just how we do it. Again, I'm not trying to say that it will work for every program and smaller schools, bigger schools, private schools, public schools. I know everybody's situation is a little bit different. So that's just how we do it. But I am always 100% honest with the kids, and I invite them to be honest back with me. Like a kid last year, I'm not going to lie, he said, "Coach, well, I don't think I got a fair shot. I think, you know, you didn't really watch me, et cetera, during these 2 days." And that was fair because that's his opinion. And so I, you know, we talked about that piece. And obviously at the varsity level, we only have 22 or 23 kids usually that try out, and I'm going to get down to 15. So I can get a pretty good idea of who's what, you know, in the 2 days. And it's not just the 2 days. Obviously we have all summer. We have June with our contact days and all of those things that play a part into it as well. So I think being honest with the kids is really important, and then really listening to them and allowing them to be honest with you in return.
Do you always keep 15?
Last year I kept 16, and I've had years in the past where I've kept as few as 13. But I try to not say, hey, we're going to do this exact number. But for practice purposes, I like to have a third group of five if we can. And then obviously I could go down and get some sophomores or some freshmen if I wanted to. But I don't want kids, you know, half the time with me, half the time with their level, half the time with me. I would rather have everybody practice, you know, relatively consistently with their group. So I like to have that third group for scouting purposes a lot, because we use the third group to kind of run the opponent stuff and that type of thing. So, you know, I don't say we're going to have this many for sure, but then when it gets to the playoffs in Illinois, you can only dress 15. So come playoff time, you're going to have to cut it down to 15 regardless.
Okay. So players 11 through 15, clearly those guys are not going to see much actual playing time in games. And as part of this process of cutting the other players, you're having this conversation with kids of, hey, you're player number 13. If we had a game today, you probably wouldn't get in the game. And it's great that there's that honest dialogue. And yet we all know that those kids in their heart of hearts, right, they're dying to play as much as player one, two, or three.
No question.
And so sometimes that's a case where you have to figure out as a coach, how do I let those kids know that they're valued, even though I can't demonstrate their value by putting them into a game as much as they would like to get in. So how do you make sure that those kids are valued so that they don't become malcontents on the end of your bench, which we've all been in situations where you've had a kid that you may have even had an honest conversation with the kid, said, hey, you're not going to play. And then all of a sudden, boom, this kid is said he was going to be okay with it. But come game three, him and his mom and dad are totally disgruntled and they become a big issue. So just how do you keep those kids engaged?
We've definitely had that before. So again, it's not perfect at Bolingbrook High School. I don't want to give the perception that it always goes exactly how it should, but to get to your question, you know, we do several little things that I think help those kids that don't get in the games as much as they want. You know, we help it along. I think it's never going to be as much as they want, obviously. One of the things is we allow them at practice to a moniker of freedom relative to, you know, who we're playing. So, for example, our number, whoever our third two guard is on in the third group, if the other team's best two guard, or their best player is their two guard, our third team two guard gets to shoot all of those balls in practice. And then one of my assistants will say something like, hey, this is your chance to show coach that he, you know, he needs to get you in there, something like that. And so those things happen. Then we recognize after almost all of our games, the groups that help us prepare for the team that we were playing. And my assistant coaches do a really, really good job of this. You know, after I do my little spiel in the post game, one of my assistants will inevitably say, hey, let's give it up for, you know, Jimmy Joe, who all week on the scout team was destroying you guys playing, you know, like whoever's two guard we were playing. And so, you know, we try to reward them that way. And then obviously, you know, we treat all our players the same relative to everything else other than playing time, if that makes sense. So, you know, we go on a lot of trips, we get a lot of gear. All of those things, I think, help our guys become better teammates. And I know that that doesn't, you know, help them get over the playing time thing, but we try to value them as much as possible, just like we try to value the kids that are on the floor as much as possible. And the other thing that I do is try to talk to all of those kids as much, if not more, than I talk to the first group or the second group, the guys that are in the regular rotation. Meaning that I'll ask number 12 on the team, just like I would ask number 4 or 5 on the team, you know, how's biology class going, all of those things, so that I have relationships with them other than just what we have on the floor. And again, that goes back to what the phrase I used earlier in the pod, that if your relationship with me depends on how much you play, if you play, or how well you play, then you're in the wrong place. We're going to care about each other regardless of those three items. And that goes both ways. I think everybody knows that and everybody feels that, more importantly, as the year goes on.
It's well said. And I think it's a lot harder to do than it is
no
to
question.
Say.
Yes.
And it's always a challenge, right? I mean, I think for any coach and for any player, ultimately, a lot of times their happiness comes down to how much do I play? And to overcome that lack of playing time, you have to be very, very intentional about all the things that you just described of pouring into those kids and valuing them and letting them know that they're valued, not just letting them know they're valued directly to them, but also in the eyes of their teammates.
No question.
Because when we're talking about kids, right, it's easy for if I'm a starter and I'm a 16-year-old junior on the team and here's this kid as a senior who's player 15 and he doesn't play very much, it's kind of easy for me to discount the value that that kid brings to the team because I'm a 16-year-old. I'm kind of inherently self-focused and worried about me and, hey, who's this guy over here that doesn't play anymore? Yeah, so I think you just – as a coach, you got to really make sure that that is something that gets emphasized. It's critical to be able to keep those guys who don't play as much engaged and let them know that you care about them and that you have a relationship with them beyond just, as you said, beyond the minutes that they play on the floor.
And we're gonna have some interesting dynamics this year because, you know, arguably one of our best players, if not our best player, quote unquote, is a freshman, an incoming freshman. My son is a sophomore. And so, you know, that brings a whole new dynamic into the whole thing. When the coach has a kid on the team, number one, and then number two, when one of the best players on the team, is a freshman. And so we're going to have, you know, some of those things, you know, crop up, during the season because we're human, you know? And so, you know, we're going to have to be on our toes with all of those. And then of course, when you play some young kids, sometimes they don't play great all the time. And so I tell our team all the time, the good news is you go to Bolingbrook High School. The bad news is you go to Bolingbrook High School because it's very competitive. And, you know, some guys that might play at some other schools may not see the floor as much at our place.
And I would say the last point to make here, I think, is as a coach, it's super important to have a pulse of your team and be aware of those undercurrents and what's happening. And part of that goes back to what you talked about, right? It's just talking to kids about, hey, how's your biology class and this and that. And sometimes those conversations just kind of naturally wind their way back to things that are going on within the team. Yes. And I think if you keep your eyes and ears open as a coach, that you're going to see and hear things that can help you to head off problems before they happen. And that's not to say that, again, you can't solve every problem. You can't make every problem go away or not happen. But the more you're keyed into what's going on in your locker room with your players, and sort of, I always think of it as kind of this undercurrent or this buzz that's going through your team, that you as a coach, if you're paying attention, you can find that stuff early and get to it before it becomes a major problem and put out small fires before they become big ones.
There's no doubt. And there's no doubt about, you know, dealing with those things when they're small fires, as you just put it, instead of letting them get to infernos and then trying to put them out is much more difficult. And, you know, I think I have a much better feel for our guys, not only how they're playing, but how they're feeling now than I did, you know, 15 years ago. And so, you know, it's not always going to be great, but we always do the best we can to keep a close tab on that for sure.
Yeah, it's probably easier to read the room today as a more experienced head coach than it was when you first started. I'm sure that's
no question.
That's an acquired skill, just like a teacher in a classroom, right? It's an acquired skill.
Like I said at the clinic I did last week in Iowa, I had my priorities really mixed up when I first started coaching. I just thought it was about plays and gathering the right plays and doing this set and, hey, what is this coach doing? Okay, I'll do this. And, you know, when Syracuse won the national title, then I was like, well, we better play 2-3 zone. And then when somebody won the national title with man, I wanted to do. And that's not – now my philosophy has completely changed from that, you know, knowing that if our kids don't feel valued, they're not going to play hard and we're not going to play well. For sure. So it's easier said than done, for sure. But I think as you get more experience coaching and as you, you know, deal with more situations on a day-to-day basis as a head coach, you're better prepared for those things that come up.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies. And most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more. All right, topic number three, putting together a schedule, which depending upon who does that scheduling and philosophy of scheduling. So let's just kind of dive into that. How do you guys do it at Bolingbrook? How's it handled? I'll give you my thoughts and opinions, kind of where I've always stood on it, and then we can kind of go back and forth.
This has been a much bigger challenge for me now. At first, I didn't worry about the schedule at all because I was so worried about all the other stuff that we had going. Now the schedule kind of rears its ugly head sometimes because of a couple factors, and I'll just kind of go through a couple things. But I've always been of the philosophy you want to kind of have a third, as far as games, a third that you think you're going to win pretty much, a third that you think you have a decent shot at losing, or it's going to be super, super competitive, and then a third that could go either way. And so that's my mentality when the schedule comes. Well, you know, we've moved to a part in our to a place in our program now where a lot of teams do not want to play us. And, you know, it's difficult to get teams to agree to a home and home. Like some teams will agree to play us at their place, but then they won't come back and give us a home game. So, you know, obviously the conference schedule is set, so that kind of takes care of itself. And then the other thing that we have to be cognizant of is we get invited to play in a lot of events that maybe some other teams don't get to. And so we have to save, you know, three or four dates for those types of things because everyone wants to make sure that they're getting the best teams at those events. So sometimes they're not finalized on the schedule, you know, until 6 months before or even, you know, 2 or 3 months before. A couple of our big games that we're playing in this year didn't get finalized until like a month ago. So the scheduling is always difficult. And then, you know, I always work hand in hand with my athletic director as well, who's really good with all of this as well. So, you know, it's not just my decision. It's not just his decision. We kind of tag team it and bounce ideas off each other. So that's how we do it. Next year, we're moving into a different conference. So we're actually going to have more conference games. So it's going to take away some of our scheduling flexibility because we have more teams in the new conference that we're going into. So, you know, scheduling is something that I think a lot of people don't really realize how critical it is. And then number two, how difficult it is because every program's at a different spot. And I think it's difficult for every program because everybody's in a different place.
What percentage of your games, like how many non-conference games do you have to schedule this year? And then how many will you have to schedule next year as you get more conference games?
Yeah, so we're going to lose four of those non-conference games that we currently have this year. So that takes away a lot of our flexibility as far as these shootouts and the other events that we play in. And so, you know, because we're going into a conference, and right now our conference has four teams on each side. So actually there's five teams on each side. So there's four teams on our side besides us that we play twice. The new conference has, I believe, six teams on each side. So that's, you know, two more games and then four more games that we won't get, you know, have flexibility with. So all of that has to be taken into account when we're scheduling. And so we're going to lose four of those non-conference games for next year that we have some flexibility this year. And next year, we're not going to have that.
As you're philosophy on scheduling change since you first started to where you are now, when you are a coach that's just taking over a program, clearly you probably want to schedule more wins so you can bank those. And then I would guess that as your program develops, it becomes more a case of giving your guys an opportunity to challenge themselves against better opponents. And my philosophy has always been that I feel like, and this is me not speaking as a head coach, so I can understand where a head coach could think differently in certain situations, but I always feel like what I would want to do is to try to get my team and my players prepared for the state tournament. So I'd want to play teams that are quality opponents that could allow me to be prepared for the state tournament. Now, that requires me to do a couple things, or it requires a couple things sort of surrounding that. One, it requires me to educate my players and their families about what the schedule actually means, right?
Yes.
Because we could have a record that maybe is not reflective of how good a team we are because we're playing such a good schedule. And then the second part of that is, you need to have an administration that is on board with that as a philosophy if that's what you're going to do. If you're going to say, okay, here in Ohio, we played 22 games. So if I say I'm going to go 12-10, but I'm going to be prepared to play deep into the state tournament because of the level of schedule I play, that's great. But maybe 12-10 doesn't look all that sparkling when you publish it in the newspaper. So talk a little bit about just how, depending on what stage your program is in, or just for you personally, how it's kind of your thought process has changed from when you first started to where you are now.
When I first started, I wanted our players to get used to winning so they understood what winning was, and understood the habits that it takes to win. And so I worried about wins and losses way, way more when I first started. Now I hardly worry about that at all. And I know some people are like, well, that's easy for you to say. You've won almost 400 games, blah, blah, blah. But it's very true. Now I'll play pretty much anybody, anywhere, and I don't care if we get drubbed by 30. You know, like if we're playing the Lakers or something like that, we're going to get, you know, thumped. So, and we're kind of unique that we're a very good high school team and a very good high school team and program in Illinois, but we're not a prep school and we're not as good as some of the national prep school teams. And so, you know, we're kind of, you know, floating in that area, if that makes sense. And so, you know, we're a public high school is what we are. And so I think a lot of these teams that say they're high school teams, they have high school aged players, but they're not high school teams.
Right. Exactly.
And so we're kind of floating in that area there. And so, you know, I don't worry about the wins and losses as much now as I did when I first started, to be perfectly honest. And, you know, I'll give you a perfect example. We got invited to play in a big shootout here in our area, and I told them I would play one certain team only because they're supposedly the best team in the state. That's who I wanted to play. They didn't want to play us, so we're not going to play in that event. And so they didn't want to play us, so we're not going to play in that event. So that's just one example of what it was. I'm not going to mention the team or anything like that because it doesn't make, you know, any difference right now. But, you know, if people knew that that team didn't want to play us, they would be like, what? They have the most talent in the state. So, you know, I think you have to pick and choose your battles, and you got to pick and choose, you know, what's good for your team. If we have to drive 3 hours or 4 hours, or if we have to spend the night, you know, all of those things factor into my decision-making process. And then, are we getting guarantee money? Are we getting meal money? Are they paying for our bus? You know, all of those things play into, you know, whether we're going to play in certain events or certain teams. So the scheduling is a large piece of it, especially now, since we've kind of established ourselves as whatever we are. I'll let somebody else, you know, judge what we are, but it's a little bit more difficult now to, you know, navigate that whole thing. And then moving to the new conference next year, it's going to be a whole nother thing because we won't have as much flexibility with it.
Will you come back and play some of the teams that are in your current conference?
I hope so. You know, this is probably not going to be a good omen for me to say this now, but we've gone through the last two seasons undefeated in our conference, and that's rarely happens. And we've done it 2 years in a row now. So, you know, we have not dominated the conference, but we've been, you know, first or second in this conference for quite some time. And so, you know, there's really, really good basketball in our conference. So, you know, for us to go undefeated in this conference again, I think that would be really, really difficult. And I think it would be, you know, I'm not saying it's impossible for us to do, but it would be, if you would have told me we would have done it the last 2 years, I would have said you're crazy. And so it's just really, really tough conference.
I think scheduling is something that not a lot of people beyond the high school coach themselves really thinks a whole lot about. Yes. I don't think players necessarily like, right. The schedule just comes out and you're like, all right, that's who we're playing. And parents and fans and stuff, I don't think they realize kind of the behind the scenes workings of trying to figure out open dates. And as you said, yes, the different spots where teams are. And once you get to a certain level and you're this good, I always think about it in terms of, you know, comparing like high school to college scheduling. You know, if you're a good mid-major,
yes,
on the college, in college basketball, I mean, nobody wants it's to come hard to your place and play. Yes. You're not getting a Power Five school to come and play at your mid-major school, even yep though you might be on that same level with them. They're just not coming to your place to play. And so then you got to go on the road, which obviously makes it a much tougher game. And so trying to find those games that are, again, going to challenge your team and hopefully help them to prepare for conference play, and whether it's NCAA tournament in college or whether it's for the state tournament in high school, there's always what seems straightforward.
Yes.
Oftentimes, as we know in coaching, things that seem straightforward from the outside are never as straightforward as we think. So I think
we did a
pretty good job of kind of laying out the scheduling idea and just talking about how and where and who kind of gets involved in it. So
no,
those are our three topics for tonight. I think we did a pretty good job of covering those. We're right about in our time range here at a little over 45 minutes. So I think we did pretty well.
Perfect.
And again, Rob, cannot thank you enough for being a part of this. These episodes are always a blast. I feel like I learn a ton from hearing you talk and bouncing ideas off of you, and hopefully the audience out there that's listening, hopefully you take a couple things away from what we talked about tonight to make your program better for yourself and for your players, your school, your community. And Rob, again, thanks for being a part of it.
It's always an honor to be on with you guys. And, you know, I've done a fair amount of these podcasts, you know, not Hoopheads podcasts, and you guys are top notch in every respect that there is. And so I'm just honored to be on with you guys. I'm honored to have a regular segment with you guys. And it's always a pleasure.
Well, thanks. We appreciate those kind words. And it's always a lot of fun. And like I've said, it's kind of become a traditional statement that I make at the end of every episode that, you know, I never would have guessed that you develop an honest to goodness friendship from a silly podcast like this. And the fact that we've been able to do that, you know, means everything to me. I mean, that's really what it's all about, is being able to use the game of basketball to connect with people and share a common passion. That's really what it's all about. So again, Rob, can't thank you enough.
Thanks, Rob,
taking the time out tonight to join us for Triple Double number 5.
Well, I appreciate Jason, you guys. Thank you.
We made it through a triple header tonight. So we did a triple double triple tonight, because we did we did our third pod of the night. We're wrapping up at about 12:30 a.m. here in Cleveland, Ohio. But hey, that's what it's all about. We love what we're doing. And again, thanks to everyone out there for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.